the sheer numbers of livelihoods that depend on small-scale fisheries. They often go unnoticed.
Decision makers have to understand how important is small-scale fisheries.
Welcome to the sixth episode of Season 3 of Ocean Insight,
the podcast series brought to you by the Meerwissen Initiative and the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development.
My name's Kira G. I'm an MSP expert and scientist working at Helmholtz Zentrum Herion in Germany. My co-host, Alison Clausen, is unable to be here today, so I'm going to be leading you through this conversation. This episode is dedicated to sustainable small-scale fisheries. We're asking, what does it take to manage sustainable small-scale fisheries to deliver positive outcomes not only for the marine environment, but also for livelihoods of the people involved? We travel to Senegal to get the view from the ground, and we're asking how small-scale fishers can make their voices heard at policy level, not least in the face of increasing competition from other maritime users. And as always, we are really excited about the guests we are hosting today. So a very warm welcome, first of all, to Nicole France, who is the lead of the Equitable Livelihoods team at the FAO Fisheries Division. And an equally warm welcome to Aliou Sall, who's a scientist, a social scientist, I should say, in Senegal, where he's been working with small-scale fishers in Senegal and other African countries as well. So very warm welcome to both of you. So before we get into any details, could I ask you to briefly introduce yourselves and also say a little bit about your current roles? And Nicole, shall we start with you?
Yeah, thank you very much, Kira. It's a pleasure being here. So I'm working in the FAO Fisheries and Aquaculture Division, where I'm leading the Equitable Livelihood team that deals primarily with small-scale fisheries, including also in inland fisheries, which is primarily all small-scale fisheries, but also with aspects such as social protection or decent employment, which are not necessarily always directly associated when one thinks about fisheries division. But as we will also discuss later, are really a fundamental part of ensuring sustainable small-scale fisheries.
Great, thank you so much. So over to you, Aliou. Sal, would you like to say a little bit about yourself?
Okay, I'm Aliou Sall. I'm a fishery socio-anthropologist. I've been working in the fisheries exactly since 1989. And I'm a director of an NGO called Creditip. At the same time, I'm involved in a couple of projects, you know, at international level. Mundus Maris also is our association, and I'm the vice president. I'm a member of the platform Too Big to Ignore, and also member of Ocean Defenders. But my main work is to promote and to claim human rights in the context of small-scale fisheries. So my main concern is blue justice. That is a narrative that we oppose to blue economy. That is an ongoing process that will really harm the condition of living of fishing communities.
Very interesting. Thank you so much. And it sounds like both of you are actually sort of on a similar track already from what I can hear. But let's begin, Nicole, by asking a fairly generic question of you first, if I may, which is related to the role small-scale fisheries are playing in the context of food security and also, you mentioned it already, poverty and eradication. But we all know that this is a sector that is under huge pressure. So I wanted to ask you, can you maybe touch upon some of the key challenges or maybe also conflicts that small-scale fishers are facing in Africa, but also beyond?
Yeah, thank you. And I think the answer to this question in relation to the main challenges has been given in a way directly by small-scale fishers and fish workers around the world. Over 10 years ago, they got together in many places around the world to identify the content of new guidelines for securing sustainable small-scale fisheries. And not surprisingly, a huge number of challenges relate to ensuring secure access to resources. Without that, the foundation of small-scale fisheries is really undermined. At the same time, despite employing 90% of the people along the capture fisheries value chains, small-scale fisheries still often remain overlooked. And reasons for this include, for example, that small-scale fisheries are often informal in nature, in their activities. They're often remotely located in communities along stretches of coasts, and they often lack organizations and voice. On the other hand, access to resources as such is also not enough. With rights come responsibilities. So sustainable resource management is another major challenge. It requires organization capacity, it requires a deep knowledge of the natural environment, and it often also requires a legal recognition of the traditional management systems or decentralized co-management arrangements to really enable the communities to operationalize their rights. So interestingly, though, the consultation process for the small-scale fisheries guidelines reflected also how interlinked responsible fisheries and social development are. And the process, in fact, identified challenges that relates to ensuring access to social services or to education. They also brought out issues that relate to employment and decent work, for example, in relation to the presence of child labor of migrant workers in the sector. So everything that is happening on in terms of processing and marketing is equally part of small-scale fisheries, and it's equally important for sustainable management to have value chains that are sustainable.
Thank you so much for that broad overview, and I particularly like the fact that we are very clearly taking this beyond, you know, the physical environment where fishing takes place and actually thinking about livelihoods in a much broader context. We are thinking of justice aspects, of access aspects, gender equality, and so on. So it's a very, very broad picture, which is clearly linked also to, you know, the economics of it and markets and ways of actually then selling a product that is being generated. I wonder if we can just touch upon the challenges with regards to area conservation targets that are coming to the fore. Is there anything specific, do you think, that is a challenge to small-scale fishers coming from that?
This message of area-based conservation measures and the 30 by 30 is a message that's very easy to communicate. So it's often also simplified to translate into a call for marine protected areas. And in reality, this target actually allows also for other effective area-based conservation measures, also known as OECMs. This is kind of a new concept, and there's still some confusion about it. Importantly, spatial conservation measures are often implemented in coastal areas under the lead of environmental agencies or organizations, and they don't necessarily take into account the small-scale fisheries that are operating in such areas. This may result in non-compliance with such marine protected areas or even physical violence at times. We have seen some cases between those defending the marine protected areas and small-scale fishers, who obviously see themselves deprived of the basis of their livelihood and often without alternatives.
Thank you so much. I'd like to come to Aliou to ask you a bit more about your experience with small-scale fishers in Senegal. So, in terms of these challenges, would you say that you can confirm that these are important and continue to be important?
Yes, thanks a lot. I would like briefly to start by supporting what Nicole said. I'm very surprised to realize that despite the important, you know, role and place occupied by small-scale fisheries, you know, in our countries, the fishing communities haven't yet got enough influence in order to influence, you know, the policies making process. But there is something more important, because the fishers are suffering from what I call a systemic marginalization. Myself, I'm involved in social fish worker social movement since 1989, but the official discourse didn't change. Before they can be recognized, you know, the role they play must be correctly evaluated and assessed. We don't have the number of people, exact number of people involved with fisheries. The last surveys, you know, have been done in 2015, talking about, I don't know, 110,000 per person, you know, globally speaking, engaged on small fisheries. But you can't rely on these data, you know. That means, you know, all the reports that have been made by the Senegalese government are wrong. You can't rely on that. So one thing is the recognition. Because if you don't have this recognition, you can't have visibility. And when I talk about the invisibility of small-scale fishers, women are even less visible than men who are engaged in harvesting, operations. And the best way, I think, to demonstrate that there is some will from the government to recognize is to give figures concerning fishers, people who are engaged in the fisheries, what are the exact contribution, for example, to the GDP, et cetera, and et cetera. So this is just what I want to just summarize in terms of challenges,
Thank you. Can you maybe also say a little bit about the knowledge gaps that still exist when it comes to promoting sustainable fisheries and also bringing together sustainable fisheries with biodiversity conservation?
What's happening now is against any attempt, to promote knowledge sharing. The informal and the formal sector, used to coexist. It's a kind of symbiosis. We used to have, for example, for fish access regulation, some traditional mechanism, that have been, under the control of chief fishers and all that have used to be valued. There was, a channel, between local knowledge and expertise from university. But it looks like it seems to be with the World Bank, they established, some kind of, I don't know what they call, CLPA. It's a local committee for fisheries that, the government is promoting. And these local fishing committees are, how we say, in a kind of what we call a conflict of competence. There is competition now between this traditional, system of regulation and the new systems that have been, it's a top-down system. But in Senegal, we are developing a concept of small-scale fisheries academy, whose main objective is to promote knowledge sharing between scientists and fishing communities. It's a project that is going on since 3, 4 years, and even we try to promote the small-scale fishery guidelines throughout, this platform, and even the ecosystem approach of fishery also. But it's not a physical institution; it's just, a platform, a digital platform.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for that very important voice from the ground, so to speak. And what stands out for me is really that, when we talk about research and science and knowledge gaps, there's actually maybe a bigger gap, even when it comes to the social sciences and economic sciences or political sciences rather than the biological sciences. And also, you both touched upon this or the importance of recognition, and that entails organization of some sort and being represented at different levels, at different scales, and making sure that the different people who are making up these small scale fisheries are represented in such organizations, which are then again, I guess, represented at higher levels. But you touched upon the voluntary guidelines also, and I want to come back to you, Nicole, to ask you about progress, because the voluntary guidelines have been in place for, is it 10 years? I wanted to ask whether you have actually seen any progress in those 10 years, and where would you say the biggest change is still needed to make sure that we do come to not only effective management of small-scale fisheries, but also, greater fairness and perhaps that elusive goal of blue justice.
Yeah, I think many steps have been taken over the last 10 years to implement the small-scale fisheries guidelines, and probably this has overall contributed that there's a slightly better policy environment. At the global level, we see that the small-scale fisheries guidelines are now reflected in or have been taken up by many processes. But the small-scale fisheries guidelines are also taken up beyond fisheries. For example, in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other People Working in Rural Areas, which is a new human rights instrument. At the regional level, we can see that basically all relevant regional organizations have included the small-scale fisheries guidelines in their strategies and policies. We also see that funders and development partners are increasingly referencing and adhering to the small scale fisheries guidelines and their funding strategies, which obviously is also quite important. The real challenge obviously lies at the national and local level, because that is where the rubber will hit the road. This is where we will see if it's more than paper, if we can really walk the talk and make a difference. The guidelines are very broad, so having countries embracing them is not a small feat. This is why we're quite happy to now see that the number of countries are actually committing to turn these voluntary guidelines into elements of their regulatory frameworks, for example, or to develop and implement national plans of action for small-scale fisheries. In Tanzania, Malawi, and in Namibia, we now have dedicated women small-scale fish organizations that did not exist before and that are associated to a Pan-African network called AFISHNET. For example, in Tanzania, this new women organization has already engaged in policymaking. They were invited to share comments on a regulatory framework that will have an impact on their livelihoods. So those are small things that we hope to see more of. We need more evidence on the contribution of small-scale fisheries. For example, also, what is the nutritional value of small-scale fisheries catch? No? Who consumes that catch? Because being more aware of that may trigger rethinking how management decisions are taken. No? For example, what do we want to manage for? Is it to maximize economic returns from a fishery? Or is it maybe to ensure the nutritional benefits of the most marginalized parts of the population? So maybe a mix of both. But being aware of those functions and the related trade-offs is fundamental to then have management decisions that are well-informed and evidence-based.
Thank you. Yes, some really, really important points there. I hear you in all of those aspects, especially also when it comes to the diversity of the different small-scale fishing communities and fisheries. I think that's a really, really crucial point, that we can't have a solution that fits all necessarily, even though there are, of course, common principles. And I really like your point, Nicole, that, you know, we need to know what exactly are we managing for. I wanted to ask you, Ali, are there any specific aspects you might like to add on the voluntary guidelines coming from Senegal or your experience with small-scale fishers?
I would like just to put in parallel what is written in document and what's going on even today, you know, because the guideline is very insisting on right to access to resources. But what does mean, you know, blue economy, you know, in connection with this traditional right to access to resources? There is now, spatial competition, spatial conflict, you know, induced by blue economy. Many women, you know, have been dislocated from the place they used to work. You go to Saint Louis, that is the capital of the processing sector in Senegal. You have, for example, the gas and oil that will be exploited in the border between Senegal and the nestle, meaning, you know, the nestle, the rocks of fishers used to go to catch, you know, noble fish, has become now a reserve zone, you know, for oil, for gas exploitation. Women are the most impacted when we talk about dislocation of people from the coast to another place. But these are people engaged in processing and marketing and who are working on the beach. I think, you know, it's a very important, you know, the guidelines has become more indispensable in the context of blue economy in connection with the spatial conflict to access to land. And I think the main problem we had now is also related to what we call the gap implementation. For the case of Senegal, we are very concerned about the implementation gap of the ecosystem approach that has to be done in this context of, you know, extractive, because it has become more necessary than before. For me, the only perspective we can have for the implementation of the small guideline will come from a strong organization. The lacking piece of the puzzle is to have fish workers organization who can go far beyond, you know, participating to seminar in international meeting and trying to influence locally, nationally here in Senegal the decision-making process by maybe establishing some alliance with a national parliament, national assembly, even other organizations that are not in fisheries, like, for example, Human Rights Watch. If you see that, farmers succeed in modifying policies throughout their organization, but in the fishery, I don't see any change. I'm really sorry. Now, sorry for that, but I wanted just to make this statement.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine. It actually leads on very nicely, I think, to a question that I was going to ask you later in our conversation, which is, in fact, what does need to change so that small scale fishers are, in fact, heard more in the policy process, especially because, as you've touched upon very, very impressively, there is so much competition also from other users of the sea, and governments tend to listen to the bigger, more important sectors more readily, like oil and gas, probably, than the small scale fishers. You've already given some ideas as to what could happen or is beginning to happen, maybe, but what else do you think? And it's a question to both of you, really. What else do you think needs to change? Nicole, do you want to make a start on that one?
Yeah. So again, I think it goes back to the need to really continue to raise awareness of the understanding of small scale fisheries, no? Of the importance in, for example, in maritime space, no? Just the sheer numbers of livelihoods that depend on small scale fisheries. They often go unnoticed, but that is fundamental to understand because otherwise they will not be considered in, for example, what is called the blue economy, blue growth dynamics that we can observe. Because again, that goes to the second point, no? This lack of organizational capacity, this lack of speaking with one voice to engage in those processes. This keeps all of those people in the shade and outside of these processes. Also because often these processes are attached to economic growth. And small-scale fisheries is often not identified as being a sector that holds potential for growth, which is again, it depends on how we define growth. Is it entirely just economic growth, or do we also look at values related to social cohesion? Are we looking at the innovative capacity within the sector? Are we considering, for example, the carbon footprint of the sector compared to some of the other production systems? So there are many aspects that need to be much better understood and communicated. So unpacking this new global biodiversity framework, for example, and then see how to constructively engage in its implementation. That can happen, for example, also through participatory community-based management measures. And that can really then become an opportunity that makes a real difference on the ground, because if that can be demonstrated, that there is sustainable management in small scale fisheries. This, in a way, will then reinforce access rights, no? Which, in a way, will reinforce stewardship, no? And the sense of ownership over the resource. So, in a way, it can be an entry point for something that really triggers and reinforces positive change. But it needs that process of capacity development. And here, I think some partners can come in and play a role. The Small Scale Fisheries Academy that Alio's involved in. To a certain extent, I think also academia, if there's approach of co-production of knowledge, no? To really help strengthen those related capacities.
Yeah, thank you very much. Strong messages really coming from you there, Nicole. Ali, would you like to add your view to that?
I think it's I think our decision makers hasn't understand and doesn't know what does mean small scale fishery. It's a big problem. I'm sure they don't know. But policy decision makers have to understand how important is small scale fisheries at economic level, at social level. I don't even talk about the cultural dimension of fishery. Evaluating for the first time, maybe just in terms of pilot project, a first assessment of how many employment are created by small scale fishery in these countries. If you don't understand, you can't consider. The other thing is how to value local knowledge for any management plan, for any management program. I've been working with Oceanograph with physicists who are in fisheries since years and years in the frame of CROD. That is our oceanographic center. The first time I understand how does function up the upwelling, it was explained by the fishers. We have also to change our approach while talking, while working with fishers. We used to work with national organizations. If we want to disseminate, knowledge, if we want to value knowledge, from fishing communities, let's also, even if we can't, leave aside, national organization, regional organization, let's mix it with another approach that will involve, some community approach, working with community, where things are happening, where problems are, where you have, experience in to talking about, how we say community-based management. I don't like these terms, but local, let's keep in mind how important it is to be linked, with the ground.
Definitely, that link to the ground, that's such an important point, I think. And it does bring me back to that term of co-management or community-based management or local management of fisheries or marine resources more generally. And I wonder if we can just spend just a few moments talking about some good examples. Is there maybe any approach that you can think of from your experience that does a particularly good job of co-management? And why is that example or that approach that you are thinking of working so well, do you think?
I agree with Aliu that the local knowledge, no, these local systems are crucial, and small scale fishing communities around the world are really the most effective contributors to aquatic resource and environment protection and conservation, which of course does not mean that it's all black and white and small scale fisheries is always sustainable. We have many examples also of very unsustainable practices, be it the use of dynamite or of mosquito nets for fishing with a very small mesh size. But in terms of understanding what makes co-management successful, I think there are some emerging enabling conditions that kind of seem to apply across the board. And again, one of that is to actually have a regulatory framework that provides a backing to have the right to take on the management function. However, that is not enough, no? Because again, if the capacity then to implement that lacks, it is a problem. To give a good example, though, there's one I wanna just briefly mention from Madagascar on the mangrove mud crab. This was a species that had seen a steep decline in terms of the resources because there had been a steep increase in the market demand from international, very valuable markets. No? So the market was developing faster than a protective and sustainable management system. And it really became one of the most valuable seafood export products for a comparably poor country. And that really led to overfishing. And there was a documented decrease in catches and in size, average size of the crabs. And in addition, that was all made worse because along the value chain, there were a lot of post-harvest losses. No? There was a lot of product that never reached the export market. So with the support from different partners, the communities that were harvesting this crab then got together to identify a number of actions to sustain and rebuild and make this fishery sustainable. And basically, this resulted in a set of management rules, no, about the minimum size, about the timing of the catch. And basically, the result of that was then that, in a nutshell, one can say that yeah, by fishing less, they created more value, no? Because what then reached the consumer was a product that was in a better condition, more sustainably harvested. The handling, the whole value chain dimension had also been improved so that the losses were reduced. And that ultimately then created basically a situation where, through the community activities and the consciousness that ultimately otherwise their livelihood base would finish very quickly, they agreed on a set of rules. And they agreed on those rules, which means that they respect those rules. And they improved also the related market linkages, which in this case also provides a very strong incentive to respect those rules because it creates a situation of better benefit sharing for all. Increasingly, we also see examples where marine protected areas are, for example, co-designed and co-managed really through the communities. And again, marine protected areas not under that name, but areas that had been protected have existed before that concept emerged and became very fashionable. So it's nothing that is unnatural or is imposed. It's something that really is really part of the bottom-up local traditional fisheries management system in any case.
Thank you very much for those wonderful examples. I think they sound really, really good. Aliu, would you like to add to that?
Okay, talking about co-management and success stories, I think there are two dimensions to be distinguished. You have some social regulation mechanism to regulate how to occupy the coastal zone where you want to pull your pirogue, your boat, where you have just to repair your net. We have these traditional systems that are still alive everywhere. But talking about co-management, a traditional regulation that have been initiated by fishers themselves, once it's recognized by the public, decision makers, it become co-management. We have two success stories, maybe among others. The one I know more are one in Yoff. It's Yoff is a village here, where the use of drift net monofilament are forbidden. The other one is Kayar, where or Kayar is another, in the northern coast, where also drift nets, are forbidden. That doesn't mean there is no conflict. There are conflict, of course, between local fishers and others who try to enter these zones. I would like also just to say something before I forget, which is very important because for us in Senegal, trawlings, pelagic trawlings, if it can't be forbidden forever, must be reviewed because we are in a country where 80% of the total catch are coastal small pelagics. Pelagics are very vulnerable also, are one of the most vulnerable species to climate change. So if we continue creating license to industrial fleet, this will lead to the worsening of the fish workers' communities who are already in a crisis. This, I think, we have to talk about. It was one of the issues that have been raised during the campaign we have been undertaking here in Senegal on the topics of blue justice.
Definitely. No, thank you very much. It is, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a topic we haven't specifically touched upon, the competition really between small scale fisheries and the more industrial, sort of big fisheries out there. So yeah, very important point. Thanks for raising it. Well, we are moving towards the end of this conversation as well. And as usual, we do want to look towards the future a little bit, and we also want to do this hopefully. So my question to you at the end, is what makes you hopeful when you look towards the future? And what makes you hopeful, especially that small scale fisheries can be well managed in the future and that they can, in fact, deliver more of the important social, cultural, and economic outcomes on top of environmental outcomes?
Yeah, thank you. I like to be optimistic. I think we need to be in a way. And again, I do think that very slowly we can really see a shift in mindsets, no? In with this increasing recognition of how we look at small scale fisheries, the multiple functions, and also the need to embrace diversity. And what makes me optimistic in a way is, for example, that we had in January the very first session of the FAO Committee on Fisheries Management. And many of the comments by country delegations showed that, for example, social considerations and related other livelihood outcomes are now finding their way into the way they're thinking about fisheries management. It's not only about, the stock or how to maximize a production or the maximum sustainable yield, but a lot of the recommendations that came out were about taking into account, no, the social aspects, the governance aspects, the ecosystem approach to fisheries, which cuts across the three dimensions of sustainable development. From the evidence that is emerging, we can see that if a number of attributes are present, such as suitable institutional frameworks, strong leadership, social cohesion, then co-management can really lead to improved outcomes in terms of ecological, social, and institutional benefits. I think also that we're in a collective learning process at multiple levels and for different partners. Having that collective learning process in a way will make it easier to eventually embrace the new pathway, how we think and how we approach small-scale fisheries management. FAO, we're not using the blue economy approach, but we have now what is called the blue transformation roadmap. And a last point of optimism I want to share is that this year we will hold the second small-scale fisheries summit to advance on self-identified priority issues. And for this year, for example, the issue of tenure and governance and of social development have been identified as the priority issues. So in that sense, I think small-scale fisheries have proven their resilience so far and are certainly here to stay.
Fantastic, thank you. That definitely sounds like a helpful view of the future. Aliyu, what do you think? What makes you hopeful?
The first is the fact that fishers have a potential alliance to establish with actors, players beyond the fisheries sector itself, as I said earlier, and in particularly in a country where eating fish is deeply rooted in our culinary tradition. Even our national dish is called rice and fish. So I think there are some potential, but it will depend of fish workers organization. I've been talking about how to sensitize the population, because fish is part of our, it is part of our, I would say, our body, our mind, our all. Fish and rice. The UNESCO has already considered our national dish, fish and rice, as a, how do you call,
Intangible heritage.
yes. So this has to be seized by fish workers organization. Some connection has to be done. It's very important that I try just to be more innovating based on what I have just said. Creation of job, food security, the cultural identity, association of Senegal with fish and rice and all. It's a process. That's what I want to say.
Oh, thank you so much, especially also for your positive outlooks. And what I'm taking from this, really, first of all, is that fish workers need to unite a bit more and become aware of their power and the role they are playing within wider society, which is enormous, not just in coastal regions, but for countries as a whole, for continents as a whole. And also, I really like the idea that we're moving away from the blue economy and moving more towards a blue transition. I think that's a really powerful concept and one that's really going to take us a lot more towards an integrated view and away from just economic or ecological, silo-like thinking. But yeah, I'd like to thank both of you very, very much for being part of today's podcast. So that's it, basically. Thank you very much. Well, what an interesting, revealing episode, and thanks once again to our two guests. And thank you everyone for joining us for this episode of Ocean Insight and the topic of small-scale sustainable fisheries. If you like the show, please make sure to subscribe and stay tuned for the next episode, which will be available shortly. And of course, feel free to follow, like, and share with friends and colleagues.